Thanks, Greg. Yes, we have caught up with Joshua Weilerstein. Welcome to Philadelphia.
Thank you.
Well, it's so great that you could step in at the last minute. And I guess these things happen from time to time in the business, but what's it like for you?
And I was actually preparing for a concert in Oslo, in Norway, and it was my first ever Rite of Spring. So I got this phone call, and I actually didn't pick up, and he texted me. He said, please call me back right now. So I called him back, and he said, you know, Philadelphia Orchestra, and... you know, I said, of course, it's a thrill. And, you know, you just basically, I did the concert in Oslo and then I just grabbed a score of Brahms 3 and started relearning it again.
Wow. The only difference in the program is the first piece by Caroline Shaw, On Tract for String Orchestra, which was a really engaging interplay between music that sounded familiar and sounds that didn't.
Yeah, it's a really wonderful piece. She talks about it being like looking through the looking glass, Alice in Wonderland. There's these moments where everything sounds very familiar, and then all of a sudden there's this distortion, and you kind of wonder where the sound went. It's an incredibly creative piece, also very warm and accessible and friendly, but also in a very creative way. So, you know, I think it's one of my absolute favorite pieces of contemporary music, and I'm so happy to be able to bring it here.
Well, and then we heard the Weber Clarinet Concerto No. 2 played by Ricardo Morales. What is your relationship with a soloist?
Well, for me, I played a lot of chamber music when I was a violinist, and I like to compare conducting a concerto to being a second violinist in a string quartet. And, you know, the second violin has a hugely important role, you know, as one of the inner voices with the viola. Roger Tapping, the wonderful violist in the Juilliard Quartet, he once said that the quartet is like a bottle of wine. The cello is the bottle, the first violin is the label, and the second violins and the viola are the wine. Which, you know, he's a violist, so, you know, you can take that for what it is. But I think it's a really great thing. But a lot of the second violin's role is to also support the first violinist, who has, you know, the lion's share of the melodic content and sort of leads the group in that sense. So, you know, you kind of go back and forth between playing this really important role and also supporting whatever the soloist is doing and sort of following them wherever they want to go.
Now, after intermission, we're hearing Brahms' Third Symphony, which I understand generated a lot of different theories about what it meant.
Yeah, I mean, Brahms never said ever about almost any of his pieces what he meant by them. But, you know, there's some contextual clues that he was overlooking the Rhine. He was turning 50. There's a quote from the Schumann Third Symphony in it. Brahms is in a very complicated relationship with the Schumann family, was the protege in a sense. Robert Schumann called him, you know, the leader of the new generation of composers. Robert Schumann had his mental illness difficulties, and then Brahms, of course, fell in love with Clara Schumann. While this was going on with Robert, Robert died. There was definitely thought that Brahms and Clara would get together, but they never did. And for the rest of their lives, you know, there was this, they were very close friends, sometimes enemies, but always writing letters and sort of hurting each other and then coming back to each other. And it was a, you know, very tragic story in a way. And I think it should be a movie, but it's one of the reasons it's not, is that it never had an ending. It just never, it was very ambiguous and ambivalent from both of them. So I think there is some of that in this. There's sort of, I think, Brahms becoming, not an old man, but becoming mature and sort of saying goodbye to this sort of energy and fire that he had as a young man and going into something more autumnal, as the, you know, the word everybody uses about Brahms.
So what should we listen for in this, in your approach?
Well, just one thing that Brahms was very clear to bring out is the opening. This F, A flat F, stands for three German words: frei, aber froh, free but happy. This was a little bit of a joke on his colleague and friend Joseph Joachim, who said frei, aber einsam, free but lonely. So Brahms was, I think, being a little bit sarcastic that he was single but happy with this. And so that's sort of the core of the piece, and it comes back at very important moments, and of course at the beginning and the end. I think, you know, to do the Brahms Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra, you know, so much of the sound is already there. And it's about trying to find a couple of, I think Brahms is very interesting rhythmically. He often writes two beats against three beats at the same time, so it creates this kind of clash. And that's something we were working on this week, is sort of trying to find that resistance in the rhythm that makes Brahms not feel so free. That's something that I think is really important in Brahms.
So how has your experience been in Philadelphia? You say the sound is already there in the Brahms. What do you mean?
Well, you know, there's the famous Philadelphia Orchestra sound that, you know, is so rich and warm. And, you know, for Brahms, it's just perfect. And you don't have to, you know, some orchestras you come to and they play with a very bright and brilliant sound, but it's not very warm. And so if you're doing a Brahms symphony, you have to ask them to kind of warm up and kind of deepen the sound. But that doesn't, you don't need to say that here. So you're sort of already starting on such a high level in terms of the sound world that you can really get into the details. You know, from the first rehearsal, we were already into the details of the move, of the piece.
That's great. Well, you are so busy. You have a very interesting perspective on classical music. You're the artistic director of the Lausanne Chamber Orchestra in Switzerland, mm-hmm. and you're guest conducting all over the place in Europe, in the U.S. You came from a musical family, and you were assistant conductor at the New York Philharmonic. Mm-hmm. With all that you're doing, you started a podcast called Sticky Notes. It's all about classical music. What inspired you to start that podcast?
Well, I was trying to think of what Leonard Bernstein would be doing if he was alive to sort of evangelize classical music. I read a book. It was his last long interview. The book is called Dinner with Lenny, and it's fantastic, and I really recommend it. And he just talked about being a teacher and being an evangelist of classical music. And I thought, you know, if he was alive, he would be doing something with all of the technology that we have available to us now in the way that he did with the Young People's Concerts, with TV. And so I thought, you know, there aren't almost any podcasts about classical music. Of course, there's classical radio, but you know, on-demand podcasts are such the rage in commuting and traveling. You know, I spend my life listening to podcasts in airports and on planes. So, you know, I thought there's got to be a way to do this. So I sort of settled on a format of sometimes I go through a whole piece, for example, like a Brahms symphony. Sometimes I interview an artist or an administrator. And then there's also these sort of general topics about classical music, about audiences, about the future of classical music, about specific composers that don't get attention they deserve. So it's been an amazing experience. I've been doing it for 2 years now of over 100 episodes. So it's I was amazed that there was so much interest in it, actually.
Well, there is such variety in the topics, from, as you say, episodes about particular pieces of music to crash courses in whole styles of classical music or the history of classical music, yeah. to thought pieces like 10 things to change about classical concerts. So it's very accessible to people on any level.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is that anybody, whether they're a musician, whether they're someone who comes to concerts every week, whether they're someone who has never been to a concert before but has found some interest in classical music, the idea is that there's something for you in every show, really. You know, I don't expect a musician from the Philadelphia Orchestra to listen to my show about Mahler's Fifth Symphony, for example, but I hope that there would be something interesting in there for even someone who is a professional musician. But also, it's a hard line to walk because you want to make it also extremely accessible to somebody who's never heard the music before. So I don't use a lot of technical terms, and if I do, I try to explain them right away. So, you know, depending on your interest level and your sort of immersion level, you can find something in every show. That's the idea.
Well, I was thinking as I was listening to the first half of this program with the Caroline Shaw written in 2011, adapted for string orchestra in 2014, and the Weber, which was written in 1811, and then Brahms in 1883, there was tremendous variety. And I sense in some of your podcasts the idea that people don't always appreciate the variety in classical music.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Leonard Bernstein line, the infinite variety of classical music. I mean, you can really find anything from the richness and the sort of joy of the depth of Brahms to the Italian opera of the Weber, and then to this sort of mix between, I like to say that the Shaw, you know, it has Haydn, Beethoven, Bartok, and bluegrass music in 11 minutes, you know, so you can really find anything. You know, all it takes is a little bit of curiosity. You know, we have the most ability ever to find any music we want, Spotify, YouTube, iTunes, you know, online, every piece of music practically that was ever written is available. And I've discovered tons of music that I program, for example, like the Shaw, online. And so, you know, whatever you're interested in, there is classical music for you.
I understand you didn't even embrace the life of a professional musician until you were in your late teens.
Yeah, I was a violinist, but very casually. And I joined a youth orchestra in Boston, the Youth Philharmonic Orchestra with Ben Zander. And we went on a tour to Panama and Guatemala And we played for thousands of kids that had never seen a symphony orchestra before. It's sort of the light bulb went on. So, you know, the podcast is an outgrowth of that experience from, you know, 16 years ago now, which was, you know, sort of realizing if the light bulb goes on, you can create real joy for that person and also an interest, a lifelong interest in the music.
So what does music mean to you now that you've embraced it as a career?
It's an oasis. It's sort of a respite from outside world, and you know, you come on stage and you work with an orchestra like this, and you know, you're just sort of making music together, and it's this sort of communal aspect of life that's so wonderful.
Great. Thank you so much, Joshua Weilerstein.
Yeah, thank you.